build a high-performing culture? This is Culture Architects. Candid conversations with extraordinary leaders sharing their biggest successes, failures, and lessons learned on their culture journeys. Here's David J. Friedman.
So welcome back to another episode of our podcast, Culture Architects. Our guest today is a fascinating guest for a lot of reasons. One, he's built a fantastic company. We're going to talk about that. But he's also created some really fascinating products that you're going to find pretty interesting. So our guest is Brad Whitchurch. Brad is the founder and the CEO and chairman of a company called Seal Shield. Brad invented, believe it or not, the world's first dishwasher safe keyboard and mouse in 2006. And that same year, he founded this company, Seal Shield, with the mission of developing technology that prevents the spread of infections in the healthcare and other industries that where that's really critical. Today, Seal Shield is not only an internationally recognized provider of infection control solutions, but it's won a ton of awards for being an incredible workplace, and it's really intentional about the people and about its culture. And at the helm of it all is our guest, Brad Whitchurch, who is a true culture architect. So Brad, welcome to the Culture Architects podcast.
Well, David, thank you for having me on the show. It's a real pleasure to be here, and thank you for that wonderful introduction.
Oh, it's great. So I want to start with a little bit of background about your product, because it's such an interesting product. So where did this whole idea come from? I mean, are you an engineer by background? Where did you come up with this idea?
Yes, I'm not an engineer by background, but I have spent my entire career in IT sales and marketing, and I worked for a number of large IT distributors and some IT manufacturers. Back in about 2003, I guess it was, I had my own manufacturer's rep firm where I took various IT products and I sold them mostly to big box retailers, names you don't hear a lot about anymore, Circuit City, CompUSA,
I remember
those kind of guys. And in 2004, I guess it was, I had a company approach me that they had made a washable keyboard that they wanted to put into big box retail. The company was out of the UK, and I introduced their keyboard to CompUSA and Circuit City, and it was honestly the worst reception I've ever gotten to a product. I practically got thrown out of CompUSA. They're like, one product company, no marketing funds, shrinking shelf space for keyboards. It looked like a non-starter. But timing's everything. And that same week, there was a front page article in USA Today that the University of Arizona had found that the average keyboard had 400 times more bacteria than a toilet seat. And it was a slow news week, and all the major news networks picked it up. And all of a sudden, my phone just started ringing off the hook from hospitals that wanted to evaluate this keyboard for their infection control efforts. And it was very exciting. I'd never done anything in healthcare. And I think that first week, we sent out about 600 eval units to various hospitals. And unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on how you look at it, I guess, that product failed everywhere. But it was obvious that if we could actually make a product that was fully submersible, maybe self-sanitizing, certainly dishwasher safe, that there was a market demand for it in the healthcare space for the purpose of infection prevention. And that's exactly what we did. I got together with some engineer friends in the industry, and together we put together the world's first dishwasher safe keyboard and mouse. We launched that product early 2007, and we had immediate demand for it. We hit the ground running, and that's a very profitable product line for us. We're still the leader in that niche of infection control keyboards and mice, and we've been able to leverage the success of that product into developing and innovating other solutions for the purpose of infection prevention in hospitals and other environments.
Very cool niche. And so when you started the company, how many people were in the company when you started?
Well, it was just me and my dad. You know, I knew that this thing was going to take off. I'd never seen this kind of reaction to a product in my entire career. So I knew we had something exciting. And I put my life's savings into it, which at the time was about $80,000. And I thought that would be enough. It wasn't. So I hit up my parents for $100,000. We thought that'd be enough. It wasn't. And my father and I ended up doing a roadshow and raising angel investment Ultimately, up to around $5 million we raised to launch the company, all through small individual angel investors, $50,000 to $100,000 at a time. And then as we really started to have success early, we had I launched the product. It was just myself and an unpaid intern at a trade show. And then, of course, we started building the team as we were growing. And we've been very fortunate to attract some really great people from the industry that have helped us along in our mission.
So how many people do you have today?
Today we're 50 people.
Got it. And so somewhere along the way, clearly, I mean, we're talking about being culture architects, and I look at your website and culture is all over that website and, you know, your ownership thinking, which we'll get into. But where in this journey did this like thought occur to you where you thought, you know, building a team of people and a certain kind of culture is critical to our success? I mean, all of your background, as I hear it, is on electronic sales and product focused. And you get this great product and this is all great. Somewhere in there, something sparked in your brain that said the people part of this is pretty darn important. Like, where did that come from?
Absolutely. Well, it has been a little bit of an evolution. When I started the company, one of the original missions was I want to make a company that would be the kind of company I would want to work for. And I'd worked for large and small companies. I'd seen some good. I'd seen a lot of bad. And I really wanted to avoid some of the pitfalls that made work just not fun. There's things we can do to make it more inspiring, more energizing. But even with that philosophy, I had to learn along the way. And one of the big contributors to my education and my philosophies today was when I joined a group called Vistage. And it's the world's largest, I think you're familiar with it, David, the world's largest CEO peer mentoring group. And I got a lot of great insight from that group, from great guest speakers, people like yourself. But also, I got a lot of insight from what I could see as failures in entrepreneurs or leaders that in many cases were much smarter than me, but were unable to scale themselves, that they had to touch everything. And it finally occurred to me that, well, if there's only so many hours in the day and there's only so many days in the week, and I can only work so much of that, unless I can have people that I trust who share my inspiration and motivation, then we can't scale this operation. And from there, we really flowed into some of the best practices and cultural aspects that we've brought on for that mission. We want people aligned in their inspiration, in their mission, and in their motivation, and perform at their highest level towards our joint goal.
It seems like such an obvious thing.
And it does.
You know, in my career, it was a very similar experience that when I ran my first company, all of those things that we did, like you, that just seemed obvious to me. Like, why wouldn't you do those things? Things like, you know, open book management, which we practiced in both my first and second company. When I read about that in my early career, that when I first saw the first early books, you know, on open book management, I thought, well, why wouldn't you do that? That would make a lot of sense. And it seems so strange to me that for so many, those kinds of ways of getting a workforce aligned would be surprising to some.
You know, it is interesting. I think in many ways we're stuck in some of this 80s or 90s management philosophy. And really the field of study of leadership has come so much further. And if we invest in ourselves as leaders and really invest in embracing the best practices of empathy and helping people, servant leadership, getting the best out of people, then as you say, it's obvious what the outcomes will be.
Yeah. So what was, take me back to the beginning. So it was you, your dad helping to raise money, a few of you, and you're now starting to build a team. What were some of the first things that you did from a culture standpoint to start to establish these practices that now have become just second nature to you? What were the first things?
Well, I can tell you that when we started out and it was a handful of founders, we really had a self-serving interest. We wanted to make sure we had the very best benefits for our small group of founders. Mm-hmm. And then as we realized how much we enjoyed those benefits, and as we grew the company, it seemed natural that we should extend that same philosophy to everyone in the organization. And I think one of the big turning points for me was we had a Vistage guest speaker, Brad Hams, who wrote the book Ownership Thinking. And then we hired Brad to come out to Seal Shield and do a program with us at one of our corporate retreats. And it just really opened up my mind to how far we can take this philosophy. And as you said, it comes back to, you know, having open book management, and there's a profit sharing element. So certainly if you're going to have profit sharing, you better have full transparency on the books. Otherwise, you know, who knows what's really happening. And just a lot of the steps that Brad laid out for equity sharing, profit sharing, full transparency, we embrace those. And then over time, we've evolved that and made it our own. And it's something we're very proud of, our ownership thinking culture at Seal Shield.
You know, when I remember when I first got exposed to the whole ownership thinking and as I call it, open book management philosophy, I remember there was an analogy that I read from one of the early writers about open book management. I'm trying to think of his name. John Case has written a lot, but who was the Springfield Remanufacturing, I can't think of the name of the CEO, who was Jack Stack. Jack Stack was probably the foremost leader in writing and thinking about open book management. He had a company called Springfield Remanufacturing in Springfield, Missouri, and he had created this open book management and a whole, there's an annual conference and all kinds of things out of that. But what I was going to say about that is that there's an analogy that he wrote about in his very first book that just resonated with me. It was such a simple thing. And he said that the way we typically do business would be like, imagine that we're playing any sport, let's call it basketball. And we say to our team, here's the deal. If we win the championship, everybody's going to get a bonus. But I'm not going to tell you what the rules are, and I'm not going to tell you what the score is, but I'll let you know whether we won or lost. That's kind of how we do business. And that would be pretty stupid. And so why wouldn't we want people to know how to win, what the rules of the game are, how do you make money, and how are we doing so far, and being transparent about that so that they could take the actions necessary to achieve that result? That seems pretty darn obvious.
Absolutely. And yet
it is fascinating how few do that.
Right, and so to your point, you know, that's that was really Brad Hamm's story as well. If you remember, Brad was brought on to be the CEO of Mrs. Fields Mexico, so the cookie manufacturer. They'd gone public, they outsourced their manufacturing to Mexico, and they were having significant profitability problems. They hired Brad to go figure out what the issue was, and so he moved to Mexico. And what he found was that there was a huge disconnect between the factory line workers and the financial objectives of management. And by teaching these factory line workers how to read basic financial statements, having full transparency, open books with a profit sharing incentive, he was able to completely flip the script, get the frontline factory workers aligned with the financial goals of management, sharing the same motivation and incentive, and they had success. And Brad said, well, if I can do this with Mexican factory workers, I can do it with anybody. And that resonated with me as well, and we've had success with it.
That's great. So when you first rolled that out in your company, how did your people respond to that? Was there any cynicism or even doubting, particularly people coming from previous backgrounds where people didn't share so much? Did anybody wonder, well, what's Brad really doing here? What's the game?
You know what I found is when you're consistent about having a culture of continuous improvement, that people are much more accepting. I found that I've developed enough street cred that people are willing to give me the benefit of the doubt. David, what I find, though, is people, employees, parents, or spouses, they're very skeptical. They say, wait a minute, they're not giving me the real numbers. And I say, yes, they are. So I think we have some pretty good street cred, because you have to be consistent about these things. And it's not just one thing. It isn't just ownership thinking. You know, a lot of it is attracting the best people and attracting people who will commit to invest in themselves to be the best they can be. We have to all commit to a culture of continuous improvement to be the best that we can be, and to help each other be the best we can be, so that we can be the best we can be as an organization. And we've had that philosophy that's carried through. We've really focused on having what I would consider world-class benefits, certainly for a company our size, so that we can attract and retain the very best people. And for example, we have a zero out-of-pocket healthcare policy. It's an HSA program. We pay 100% of the premium, and we contribute to everyone's HSA accounts the IRS max, which covers 100% of their deductible, or actually can be the best savings program government incentive that's offered. So we have a 401k that's a 4% contribution, not a 4% match. Mm-hmm. We give everybody 4%, and then we encourage them to invest more. And our CFO does a presentation for everyone when they begin, and as a group every year on how to become a 401k millionaire. And you can do the same thing with this HSA program. But unlike the 401k program, which is tax deferred, the HSA program is tax-free for your life if you're using that money for healthcare, and it can be rolled over into an IRA upon retirement. So we give that presentation, how to be an HSA millionaire. Our CFO invests in providing the LinkedIn learnings for our employees to help with their personal financial goals. It really comes down to empathy, doing everything you can for the employees, investing in them so that they agree to invest in themselves and the whole organization gets better. And by offering just world-class benefits, incredible maternity program, the full healthcare costs, we get 3 days a year paid volunteerism in addition to 16 holidays and generous PTO. And it's all purposeful. It is all to create this street credibility and consistency of what's important to us. And so it's in the benefits program. It's part of our ownership thinking culture. It's core to our values. And that consistency is where we really see the results.
Yeah. So, you know, you talk about the importance of being able to attract great people and how the role that certainly your benefits plays in doing that. One of the things that every client, certainly everybody, is dealing with right now is the challenge of finding good people and holding on to them. Obviously, your benefits play a big role in that. But you also mentioned the importance of finding the kind of people who would fit in your organization, because there are people who would be attracted to it, but that doesn't mean they'd be good for you. You know, they would love to work there, but you might not think that they're the kind of quality people that you're looking for. So how do you go about in your screening process when you're recruiting, finding people that would be a good cultural fit for your organization?
Well, that's a great question, David, and it is something that we're very conscious of and that we're looking at when we're recruiting people. As a small company, you know, of course, we're always juggling limited resources. That's the game we're playing all the time. What can you get out of what you can put in? And one of our customers actually approached us, and he said, look, I really want to work for you guys. I think the culture is amazing. And this particular person actually happens to be a legitimate germaphobe. So everything we do spoke to this guy, and he was a high-level IT guy with one of our big customers. And I said, you know, I would love to have you on board, but I just don't know if it makes sense for a guy of your, you know, salary requirements in an IT role in a small company like this. And Steve Miklos is this guy's name. And he said, well, you know, I also just got my master's in HR. Maybe that would be a help. And of course, for a small company to have HR resources is a real luxury. But I kind of thought, well, you know, if you can wear a couple of hats, maybe this makes sense. So I really hired him as an IT guy with maybe some side benefits in HR. What we found was that there's so much benefit to having a dedicated HR and the right person in that seat. We've gotten so much value out of having Steve in that role, and he's really embraced the requirements of fitting the corporate culture at Seal Shield. And we've implemented through Steve's leadership a lot of amazing tools that help with that. One that I just think is one of the best is called Spark Hire. I don't know if you're familiar with that.
I've not seen that.
It allows us to do a video interview before we even get anyone involved. So it's all automated. It's 10 questions. The person who is interviewing can take it anytime they want. But then there's some rules. They get 30 seconds per question to answer the question. They can skip one. But it's really putting people in an uncomfortable situation where they're doing a self-interview of themselves videoed.
Interesting.
And so you really see how people respond to that uncomfortable situation. Steve crafts the question, and there's always one or two kind of funny, culturally insightful questions snuck in there, and it's interesting to see how people respond to those. And then the tool allows us to share those videos amongst the leadership team, rate the candidates before we even have to start scheduling in-person interviews. So it's a frontline kind of, I don't want to say weed out, but a frontline assessment tool that allows us to be efficient in the process. And one of the main goals with that tool is to identify those cultural attributes early on, because you're right. And we've all made that mistake where you get, you know, kind of starry-eyed over the resume and the capabilities. And we've had some incredibly intelligent, gifted people that at the end of the day, you just have to pull out the, excuse me, the no asshole policy and say, you know, we just can't, you're great, but we can't put up with you anymore. And so when we've made those mistakes, and they're expensive mistakes, you get really conscious of looking at those attributes and those aspects for people to be culturally successful at the onset of the process.
Makes a lot of sense. So for the sake of our audience and me for that matter, so tell me again the name of that tool.
It's called Spark Hire. So it's S-P-A-R-K Hire, H-I-R-E.
Sounds like I've never heard of that. It sounds like a great tool that many people can benefit from. Yeah, I'll check that out. And that concludes the first part of my interview with Brad Whitchurch, the founder, CEO, and chairman of SealShield. In the next part of our conversation, Brad and I are going to talk more about how to find the right people for your organization, as well as the pandemic's effect on the SealShield culture.
This has been Culture Architects with David J. Friedman. Join us next time for more insights and wisdom from great leaders in all walks of life. To book David for your next event, or to learn more about his writing, speaking, or consulting, go to davidjfriedman.com. Culture Architects with David J. Friedman is a production of CultureWise.